Good morning. I want to welcome you to the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship of Manhattan. Whether this is your first or 400th visit, you are welcome here. We strive to embrace and include all in a loving and caring community at the same time as we try to create a world that is diverse, hospitable, joyous, and just. Wherever you have come from, whoever you are, whoever you love, whatever your journey has been, it has led you here, and we're glad you're here. Before we begin the service, I want to draw your attention to announcements printed inside your bulletin. There are some events coming up soon. I also want to let you know that we're going to have a work day here at the Fellowship on Saturday, September 17th, and if you want more information, you can contact Sylvia Beeman or Mark Mayfield, or watch your email or the Facebook group. We'll try and get that information out to you. Our chalice lighting today comes from Christian Schmidt. Let us wake up, not just from the Sunday morning exhaustion, from the wish for a few more drowsy minutes in bed. Let us wake up to this world we live in, to its beauty and wonder, and also to its tragedy and pain. We must wake up to this reality, that not all in our world have what we do, however much or little that is. We must wake up to the idea that our wholeness, our lives, are only as complete as the lives of those around us, of those we are inextricably tied to in a great web of mutuality, of which all of us are a part. We must stay woke, in the words of our friends and colleagues involved in Black Lives Matter, working every day for racial justice in our country. Let us wake up. Let us stay awake. Let us stay woke. And now, in this time and place, let us worship together. Now stand as you're able and join us in singing our opening hymn. The words are printed in your bulletin for what it's worth.
Your life, it will creep. It starts with sing. Okay? Now is the time in our service when we share those significant joys and sorrows we carry in our hearts and minds. By sharing heavy burdens, they are lightened. By sharing joys, they grow. Please wait for the microphone so that all will hear you. We have any?
I think most of you know I'm Jonna Lou.
Mm-hmm.
Some weeks ago, I said in this time that my 90-year-old aunt had died in a car wreck. And this week, her widow had a massive stroke and died yesterday.
Oh.
So it's one of those situations where grief strikes deep, and I think it killed him. So,
I'm Kathy Hedge, and I want to thank those of you who have given me words of comfort in my mom's passing. She passed away, and we had a great celebration for her last Saturday, and when she was dying, it happened very quickly after Amy and Thurston and I, the week we came to visit, and she was clear-headed, had all her kids say goodbye, and we had a grand party to send her off, so it was a life well lived.
Hi, I'm Kristen Corwin. My son, Logan Washburn, turned 6 on Friday.
Yay! Okay. You want me to? I'll introduce you, Miss Torch.
Hello, my family brought Aunt Julie with us today. She lives in Harlem, but she came to see what this Manhattan was all about. She's been here before, but you know.
Hello.
Hi, Larry Weaver. I'm happy to say that we have two more college students here this Sunday. In addition to the physics student, Gautam, we have a biotech, Sophia, and a math and art major, Megan. So.
Welcome.
I'm happy to see my family's friend, Richard Pitts, is here.
Yay.
My name is Piper, and I just started kindergarten, and my teacher's name is Mr. Payne.
Yay. That it? We'll see. Nobody else? We'll have the choir sing I Am Willing.
Story time, story time. Come on up front for story, young people or old. Hope you can all see. Is this okay? I'm going to read you a story written by a man, Julius Lester, and it's called Let's Talk About Race. I think that's Julius when he was a baby. Do you see anybody here who looks like you?
Meow.
All kinds of people in the world. I am a story. Julius is a story. So are you. So is everyone. Julius's story began the same way that yours does. Take him, for example. He was born in January 27th, 1939, in St. Louis, Missouri. He's pretty old, huh? Almost 80. Do you know when you were born? Do all of you know your birthdays? Yes, Jake. In 2000? Oh, Oh, December 28th, 2007. And yes? Next March is your birthday. 2011? And Rose? February 19th, 2011. And Piper? Oh, whoops. 2007. Okay. Oh, and yes, Piper? Oh, and happy birthday in advance. And yes? December 1st, winter guy. Well, how does your story begin? Many people and many events are part of Julius' story and part of yours too. The names of our parents and where we were born, whether or not we had any brothers or sisters. I had two brothers and a sister. Julius had a brother who was 9 years older than him, and he's dead now. What kind of work our parents do or did? Julius's father was a minister, and his mother was a housewife. Julius's story and yours have many elements, such as favorite food. Would someone like to tell their favorite food? Yes. Oh, ravioli?
No.
Lasagna?
Yes, lasagna.
Oh, okay. And so Julius is his fish. And hobbies. His favorite hobby is crossword puzzles, taking pictures, and cooking. And do you have a hobby?
Yeah, my favorite hobby.
Oh. Oh, anyone else have a favorite hobby? Sorry, Rose. Collecting rocks. I like that too. And?
Salmon.
Oh, salmon's your favorite food? Oh, yummy. And your favorite color? Julius is, he said red or maybe green. And then he said, but I like orange and purple too. But actually, he likes all the colors. And his religion is Jewish. Do you know what your religion is? Yes. What? Atheist, okay. Well, there we go. And nationality, what country you were born in? Julius was born in the United States. He considers himself from the United States. Favorite time of day? Night, yes. Julius is too. Evening. That's pretty beautiful too. Who said day? Oh, early morning. Okay, lots of. And there's something else that's part of Julius' story and ours. It's your race. And Julius is black. And what race are you? Here are lots of whites. When people, usually we're judged by how our skin color is. And people look at me and say, I'm white, but I know that my heritage is very mixed.
Just as I am a story, and you are a story, and countries tell stories about themselves, race is a story too. Whether you're black, like Julius, or Asian, Hispanic, or white, like most of us, each race has a story about itself, and that story is almost always the same. My race is better than your race. Some stories are true, some are not. Those who say my race is better than your race are telling a story that is not true. Why would some people say their race is better than another? Because they feel bad about themselves? Because they are afraid? Because, any other ideas? Just because they can. Yes? Because they see differences in other people? But there are other ways all of us, even me or you, think we're better than others. I'm better than you because I live in a big house. I'm better than you because I'm a boy. Or I'm a girl. I'm better than you because my dad and mom make more money than your mom and dad. I'm better than you because I'm white. I'm better because I'm black. I'm better than you because I'm Hispanic. I'm better than you because I'm Asian. None of these stories are true, are they? I want to tell you a true story, but I need your help. This is what you need to do. Put your fingers right below your eyes and press. What is that hard thing you feel? It's what's it made out of? Bone. It's bone. Press somewhere else, like your elbow or your knee. What do you feel under your skin? Yes. Beneath everyone's skin are the same hard bones. Like the same hard thing that's hitting the floor. Those are your bones. It's making that noise. If you were to go outside without your skin on and without your hair on your head, this is what you would look like. But you want to know something? If I went outside without my skin, I would look just like you, and you would look just like me. Suppose one day all of us in the whole world decided to take off our clothes and all our skin and all our hair. Then we would do whatever we normally do every day, go to school, work, play, shop. Everything would be normal, except we would look at each other and couldn't tell who was white, black, Hispanic, or Asian. Which story shall we believe? The one that says, my race is better than yours, or the one just discovered for ourselves beneath our skin? I look like you, and you look like me, and she looks like her, and he looks like her, and she looks like him, and we look like them, and we all are alike under our skin. Or do I see only the color of your skin, or the shape of your eyes, or the texture of your hair? Do I look at you and think I know your story when I don't even know your name? Or do I look at you and wonder, what's your name? Where were you born? And what do you like? What do you not like? Gee, maybe we like and dislike the same things. Your race is not all that you are. My race is not all that I am. Julius is black, but there are also a lot of other things about him. He was medium height. He has a very deep voice. He likes to laugh. Well, I like to laugh. Do you? Not so much. Oh, well. Some things aren't funny, I know. Julius lives in a big house in the woods, and his favorite food he also likes, besides fish, pancakes and macaroni and cheese, and there he is. I'm so many things besides my race, says Julius. He knows his story. You have to put all those things about him together to know who he is. Beneath the skin, we all look alike, you and me. I'll take off my skin. Will you take off yours? I know it's not really possible. You'd die. Thank you. Oh, well. Thanks for sharing the story with me, and you can go to your classes now.
Oh, and love our hearts so with you.
I am only one, but still I am one. I cannot do everything, but still I can do something. And because I cannot do everything, I will not refuse to do the something that I can do. And in that spirit, let us now receive our offering.
Letters to the Manhattan Mercury, July 21st, 2016, to the editor. In 2010, the Coalition for Equal Justice began a study on Riley County Police Department rates of marijuana arrests by race. Among its findings were that in 2010, blacks were 2.8 times more likely to be arrested by the RCPD than whites, and in 2013, blacks were 4.2 times more likely to be arrested for marijuana possession than whites. Yet the numbers also show that the rate of marijuana possession is basically the same between whites and blacks. It is this kind of behavior that has created the impetus for movements like Black Lives Matter. I now think it's high time we quit ignoring the behavior of some of our police officers just because they wear a uniform and a badge. I've lived in this city for the majority of my life. I've been pulled over and stopped countless times by police here for things as varied as a busted taillight, a car with one headlight working, a blinker not operating, a license plate light supposedly not working, all things that white friends said they have never heard of being stopped for. One evening a few years ago, I drove to a convenience store to get a bottle of pop and a bag of chips. I drove into the parking lot and saw a police car sitting across the street. I didn't pay any attention to it and went on about my business. I left the store after my purchase and proceeded to drive home. I was not breaking any speed laws. I was not drunk and driving, yet the police officer decided to follow me. I was in the left lane, and he was behind me. As I got closer to my turn, I changed to the right lane to make my right turn. The officer also switched from the left lane to the right lane and continued to follow me. I drove home and parked in my driveway and saw the police car drive past my house. In the process, he turned on his spotlight. These are the types of things my fellow blacks here must endure from this department, so I think we need to recognize that it is police behavior that has created the situation we see nationwide and begin to address that behavior. We cannot thank them until they do the proper thing and rid themselves of bad police officers or bad policy or both. Isaac Madison.
This is a letter to the editor, July 22nd, 2016, the next day. This is in regard to Isaac Madison's letter in Thursday's Mercury, in which he wrote, "All things that white friends have never heard of being stopped for. My wife and I are both white. In the last 10 years or so, we have each been stopped by police at different times for different informational reasons. Headlights not being turned on. We had just left a brightly lit street. taillight out, headlight out, and an out-of-date license plate sticker because the county had not mailed us, and it is a time to register reminder. I don't think we are friends of Mr. Madison, but now he knows that some white people are also stopped for very minor reasons. Myron A. Calhoun.
July 31st, 2016. To the editor. Ordinarily, I do not respond to anything people may say about a letter I've written, but this time I feel compelled to because the response of Myron Calhoun is typical of some whites today. Mr. Calhoun wants to point out how he is white and gets pulled over for insignificant and minor things by the Riley County Police Department. Well, Mr. Calhoun, the point of what I wrote was the disparity in stops between whites and blacks by the RCPD, not whether you, as a white person, get stopped. I am fully aware that whites get stopped, too, but the study by the Coalition for Justice states that blacks were just over four times more likely to get stopped by the RCPD for doing something that whites do at the same rate. According to the July 27th letter in the Mercury by John Extell and Byron Williams, blacks are now stopped at nearly seven times the rate of whites by the RCPD for the same thing. The number of stops of blacks by the department for this has approximately tripled since 2010, according to the Coalition for Justice study. Instead of being concerned with these increases, Mr. Calhoun ignored them to inform me how he is stopped by the police and he is white. It is simply time for whites to stop trying to compare their experiences to ours when we speak on matters of racism. Now, I'm sorry if that offends, but the reality is that we have not had the same experiences, not even here in Manhattan. Signed, Isaac Madison.
Good morning again. Racism and anti-racism are really big, complicated topics. They're really important things to talk about. And they're very timely topics for what's been happening and continues to happen. We could speak about this every Sunday for an entire year and still be left with more to discuss. But I'm here to tell you just a little bit about a workshop that Sylvia, Sabrina, and I attended in January. Is that better? There's like this note that says don't lean into it, so I'm afraid I don't want to be too loud. So over Martin Luther King Jr. holiday weekend earlier this year, 46 participants attended the Roots of Justice anti-racism training that was hosted at the First Congregational Church downtown. It was led by three facilitators, and participants represented different religious organizations, like we did, as well as student and faculty organizations from K-State. Sponsors included the College of Ed, the K-State Library's Dow Center for Multicultural and Community Studies, the Mennonite Congregation, the Kansas-Oklahoma Conference of the UCC Justice and Witness Commission, MAPJ, First United Methodist Church, Bethel AME Church, and our own Social Action Committee. The goal was to build a common understanding of racism and to work toward long-term transformation of institutions in our community. It covered topics such as how racism intersects with other forms of oppression, colonialism, race as a social construct, as a systemic reality, white privilege, internalized racial oppression, as well as racial superiority, and institutional racism. For the benefit of the other speakers, I'm going to share some working definitions that we used during the training so we're all on the same page as we move forward. Race is complicated. I used to be an anthropology major, so if you're like me, when you look at it from a purely biological way, it doesn't exist. There are more differences within a given population of humans that share the same skin color than there are when you compare two different separate groups. There's not really a biological basis for this very small difference. Many educated liberals take this into consideration when they talk about like color blindness. But race is also a social construct we have to acknowledge. It changes the way life in our culture is experienced by different groups of people. Just as gender and sexuality exist in a specific social context, creating privileges for some and denying privileges to others, so does race. Prejudice becomes racism when one group in a society uses their power to enforce their racial prejudices over other groups in such a way that they receive more benefits while other groups receive less. In our world today, racism is rooted in the power structure created by colonialism, which is the process of aggression against a people by a country which takes the land, exploits the resources, including the indigenous people, destroys the indigenous cultures, and then requires the cultures of the colonizer to be accepted as the standard. Institutional racism is the way an institution's structures support and perpetuate race-based privileges, intentionally or not. This can include school segregation through housing patterns, sports team mascots, such as our very own at MHS, and U.S. immigration laws. Environmental racism occurs when any government, institutional, or industry action or failure to act has a negative environmental impact which disproportionately harms, whether intentionally or unintentionally, individuals, groups, or communities based on race or color. What happened in Flint, Michigan is environmental racism. Internalized racial superiority refers to the multi-generational dehumanizing development of entitlement and empowerment for whites in the United States. Speaking of whites, this term was first used in the 1600s to replace Christian and Englishman as a way to distinguish European colonists from each other and from Africans and indigenous peoples. It then became a legal concept after Bacon's Rebellion in 1676, in which indentured servants of European and African descent united against the colonial elite. This creation of white bestowed privileges on some by denying it to others. Europeans from different regions have historically stood in different relationship to whiteness, depending on whether the rulers considered them in or out, such as Irish, Jews, and Italians. They've all been excluded from whiteness at some point in our country's history. But its very construct was to divide the workers as a way to benefit the elites. And this is the function it still serves today. So now that we have that like broad, quick history out of the way, I'm going to talk more about the workshop. I would really encourage anyone who hasn't experienced or attended some event like this to do it in the future. I think it's really important. For me, the most powerful part of the exercise was mapping out a linear timeline of our nation's history of racial oppression, starting with Columbus landing in the Caribbean islands, through the Civil War, the Trail of Tears, segregation, and continuing through to the murder of Michael Brown in Ferguson, the water crisis in Flint. Of course, we know that if we were to do this exercise today, there would be many more names and events to document. This is the history we know, or at least need to know. This is the history of our shared painful past and continued painful present. There's an online resource published by the Equal Justice Initiative. They make a calendar of like this day in history for racial oppression. You can order a calendar, check it out. I checked it today and realized that today is the anniversary of 14-year-old Emmett Till's brutal murder. That was 62 years ago. Or 61 years ago. But during the workshop on these same pages where the legacy of injustice was so clear, we wrote another shared history of resistance. And this is what was powerful for me. The history of enslaved peoples rising up against those in power and the white people who assisted in their resistance. The civil rights movement and the leaders we know so well, like Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., but we also noted the white allies and activists who stood beside and marched behind him. The continued resistance by the Black Lives Matter movement, the protests in Ferguson, the recent vigils here and across the country. These are all just snapshots, but we filled six huge sheets of paper covering two entire walls with act after act of anti-racist activism. It provided a context to understand that there have always been people standing on the side of love,
standing up against oppression, acting and risking their lives and dying for justice. So what does this mean for us as a community? How do we do the work of anti-racism, and what does that even mean? First, we have to recognize how our history shapes our present moments, how the election of our first Black president created the very backlash and subsequent rise of Trump we are witnessing today, how we as a predominantly white organization and as white people have the luxury to rarely have to think about the fact that we are white. Many of us pride ourselves on being colorblind. For many white people, we think of racism as an individual act, a moral shortcoming of an individual. This is how police brutality against Black men and Black boys and Black women is often categorized. Those individual officers are bad apples. And therefore, this injustice can be undone through sensitivity training or removing the officers from the force. This view of racism places the ability to change our entire society on each individual. The workshop clarified for me the concept of institutional racism. I had been researching it for school concerning disparities in the application of school discipline across racial lines and the school-to-prison pipeline. But what I learned is that we cannot view these disparities as being caused by individual teachers, districts, police officers, or law enforcement agencies. These are the direct consequences of our history, because white supremacy is built into the very fabric of our social institutions. This is why the demands of the organization Black Lives Matter does not involve diversity training, but instead calls for the demilitarization of our police forces and for external investigations when police brutality happens. It is why many activists are looking to decriminalize marijuana to reduce arrest rates. And education reformers are calling for the end of suspension and expulsion as forms of discipline in our public schools. This isn't about the individuals, it's about the system. I'm sharing all of this to illustrate the idea that anti-racism begins with actions, whereas non-racism begins with inaction. Being an anti-racist white person means coming to a healthy and functioning sense of white racial identity. As I mentioned before, I don't often have to think about being white, which is a function of racism. Our ancestors, grandparents, or great-grandparents shed their race as an identity long ago in order to assimilate into the dominant culture that benefited them. We do not, as a whole, carry race as an identity. I get to be an individual. I get to be myself. I don't have to make an adjustment or modification to name who I am. And although most of us, I would say all of us in this room, are non-racist, it's not enough. When we put up Black Lives Matter signs in our yards, we are being anti-racist. When we work with our local police department and hold them accountable for the disparity of arrest rates, we are being anti-racist. When our fellowship attends the K-State Black Student Union meetings just to listen, we are being anti-racist. I watched a great video last year that talked about how anyone can be non-racist by being asleep in our beds, but Black men will still be getting murdered by police. Just not doing racist acts isn't enough. We are called upon, especially by our faith and our faith's history of activism, to do more. We have to recognize that the racism that remains today serves a powerful function in keeping the working class divided across racial lines. Those in power do not want us to rise up together, but we will. As you use, the focus of much of our justice work has been on the victims of racism, but has largely ignored the oppressors that benefit from racism. This is where we, as a predominantly white congregation, actually carry the most influence. These are the systems we navigate within, hold power within. We can work to dismantle these structures and give up power to others. Instead of trying to make our congregation more diverse, we should instead spend more time in spaces that aren't for us and just listen and be present. We can continue to be involved in organizations working for social justice, but we also need to look critically at those systems and ask who holds the decision-making power and why. Who does it benefit? Whose voices may be lost? We need to put greater focus on the power and privilege that white people have in our racist society.
I did some research and am very proud that these ideas are not new to our faith. In 1997, the General Assembly urged UUs to examine carefully their own conscious and unconscious racism as participants in a racist society and the effect that racism has on all of our lives, regardless of color. It called on the UUA, its congregations, and other organizations to develop an ongoing process for the comprehensive institutionalization of anti-racism, and multiculturalism, understanding that whether or not a group becomes multiracial, there is always the opportunity to become anti-racist. It called on all of our faith leaders and members to engage in ongoing anti-racism training, to examine basic assumptions, structures, and functions, and in response to what is learned, to develop action plans. It encouraged all UUs to enter into relationships of sustained engagement with all people of color with a goal of opening up authentic dialogue. The statement called Toward an Anti-Racist Unitarian Universalist Association can be read in its entirety on the UUA website. So we're doing a lot of good work in our community and as a broader organization, but there is still so much more to do. Thanks.
I'd like to tell you a little bit about myself. When I was 6 years old, I lived in a trailer park, and next door neighbors was a military couple, a black doctor and a white lawyer. And I used to play tonk with the guy, the black doctor and all that, but I don't remember their names. But when I was 6 years old, I asked them, I said, "Are you two married?" And they said, "Yes, dear." And I asked, I said, "Is that legal?" They said, they laughed and they said, "Yes, dear, it's legal." They, I didn't know back about Loving versus Virginia at the time. I thought it was cool they were married. I was like, but the thing is, I didn't see that happen, that, because it was not very common back then. In Loving versus Virginia, in the case over interracial marriage, it's very interesting that his name was Loving, and case where Loving versus Virginia pitted an interracial couple, a 17-year-old Mildred Jeter, who is a black woman, and her childhood sweetheart, 23-year-old white construction worker Richard Loving, against Virginia's miscegenation laws banning marriage between blacks and whites. After marrying in Washington, D.C. and returning to their home state in 1958, the couple was charged with an unlawful cohabitation and jailed. According to the judge in this case, and I remember hearing about this, Leon M. Bazil, Almighty God created the races, white, black, yellow, Malay, and red, and he placed them on separate continents. The fact that he separated the races shows that he did not intend for the races to mix. Judge Bazil sentenced to Loving's to a year in prison to be suspended if the couple agreed to leave for the state for the next 25 years. The Lovings left Virginia and went to live with relatives in Washington, D.C. When they returned to visit family 5 years later, they were arrested for traveling together. I didn't know that was in law illegal. Inspired by the civil rights movement, Mildred Loving wrote to Attorney General Robert F. Kennedy for help. The couple was referred to the ACLU, which represented them in the landmark Supreme Court case Loving versus Virginia, which is 1967. The court ruled the state bans on interracial marriage were unconstitutional. Like I said, well, I didn't know that it wasn't illegal. I didn't know because I was a little kid, about 6 years old, but it wasn't that long ago that it was illegal. When I was a child, I had a friend named Eric who was a young black kid, and we used to be good friends. We were good friends. He moved away after a while, but you don't start out being racist because when, like my brother, I must admit he is a bit of a racist. Pretty much, very much. And his kids, when they were real little, were playing on the playground, and two African-American kids came by to play, and they started playing with each other. And you don't start out racist, but it kind of comes to you after a while. But like I said, I had a good time with my friend Eric because he lived down the street, and we used to play with each other when we were kids. Now, my dad was a bit of a racist. He was one of those Archie Bunker racists. He didn't hate anybody so much, but he had these preconceived notions of how people are. like Archie Bunker, though I didn't see the Archie Bunker show until I was older, much older, but I saw that show. I'm like, yeah, that's my dad. Yeah, that's my dad, all right. And there was also, when I was a kid, there was old cartoons that were pretty racist. One was Magical Maestro, but and if you look it up, you'll see what I'm talking about. Even the superheroes were predominantly white. It was like there weren't too many Africans or any other race for that matter being a representative. Maybe Katana, but I don't know if she was around back then. She was an Asian character in Marvel. Was it DC Universe? The first interracial kiss was in Star Trek. I used to watch Star Trek when I was a kid. It came on twice a day. And I heard that Gene Roddenberry got death threats for it. But I'm like, it was Kirk and Uhura, but they were possessed by two aliens. But they kissed each other. And that was the first interracial kiss, I'm glad to say, was in Star Trek. That's pretty cool. Now, when I was a teenager, the black kids tend to group together. I remember them playing, doing a break dancing before school started. And an example of tribalism, which is a predisposition to gather together with your tribe, be it family, religion, what have you. And like when I was in the Army, Army could be a bit of tribalism too, because it was like they said, when the black dude says, "We're not black, we're not white, we're all green." So when you're in the Army, you're all green. So when I was in the military at Fort Lee, Virginia, I enrolled at a university called Virginia State University. I enrolled on Fort Lee, and then I went there to attend the class, and I looked around like, I'm the only white person here. It was an African-American university, and I went to history class with a teacher, a black gentleman named Lucius Edwards. Sorry, there's a little Harry Potter thing. Had a big fro out here. I have a picture of him, if you want to pass that around. He's the one on the right. And he liked to tease me a little bit, but it was a very good class. We discussed the Confederate flag one time with me and Beatrice. She was an older black lady that was attending the class. And we were like, we talked about the Confederate flag, and I said, it makes me think of the Dukes of Hazzard. And they think of something different. And when I watched South Park, if any of you have ever seen that episode, Chef was like, there's something wrong with the South Park flag. And the mayor's like, well, what's wrong with it? He said, you don't know what's wrong with that flag? And she said, well, I'll bring it out and you show me what's wrong with it. And she brought out the flag, and it was four white guys hanging a black guy. And I'm like, yeah, I guess I can figure out why that flag would be considered to be a racist flag. So that's the issue there, because I wasn't sure about how to think about the flag until I saw that. I'm like, oh, okay, I see it. And probably the same way with the MHS mascot. But also, he had us do, he said, okay, we're going to do a book review on Malcolm X, his autobiography. And I said, oh, man. He said, don't worry, Miss Boker, you will like it. I'm like, okay, if you say so. So I read Malcolm X's autobiography, and I loved it. I was impressed by the man and by his extreme intelligence and all that, but I was trying to figure out how to write the paper, and I wrote it at 2 in the morning, the day it was due, because that's when I was inspired by what to say, and because I was thinking the whole night, like, what can I write about? Oh, so I wrote it as Malcolm X the Scholar. I got an A+ on the paper. I wrote how he could have been a doctor, a lawyer, a Nobel Prize-winning scientist, anything. Because if he had given the opportunity. So he kept the paper, but I did get the cover sheet, which would have the A+ on it. And he was a very good teacher. I think he's still around, because that picture is from 2015, I do believe. So I just need to figure out where he is so I can contact him again. I contacted him a while ago, but I hadn't talked to him recently. So, but I'm hoping he's still around. Well, let's see. But when I was in school, the education was mostly white-centric, and you didn't hear about many African Americans contributing to history, except for what's the guy's name? The guy with the peanut. George Washington Carver, yeah. And they talked about that, and they talked a little bit about my Martin Luther King and all that. But when I went to the African American University, I learned a lot more, a whole lot more. Like in the way, especially in the issue of slavery, because they did two chapters of slavery, and we did. He told me us about how the French down in the Louisiana and all that, when they imported slaves, they mostly imported. How do you say, carpenters, masons, and they allowed them to have one day a year where they got to have a carnival and elect king, queen. So they did that. That was very interesting. And I was like, I saw his office. I'm like, you're holding out on us, Mr. Professor Edwards. He said, yeah, well, he got to meet the Delaney sisters and everything. He was the coolest teacher I ever met. He's real neat. But let's see. Right now we have the MHS mascot. But I didn't understand why it was a big deal. But after a while, I figured out. Yeah, if they associate it with the colonization of their lands and all that, then that probably it definitely should be changed. In my opinion, though, if they say it should be changed anyway because they said so. We're all learning in this world, but. Anyway, we're all learning this world, and it's a learning experience, and we keep growing as we get older. So that's all I got to say. Thank you. And now I'll turn it over to Sylvia. Thank you.
Thanks, Grace and Sabrina. Considering racism over the past few months and weeks has spurred me to learn something about the history of race in the places I've lived and to consider the source and depths of my own internalized racism. I'm the only person in my family who was born in North Carolina, but I discovered that my great-great-great-grandmother was also born there, and her name was the exact same as mine, Sylvia Kale. We found her name listed in the Bastardy Bonds of North Carolina. Her father was a Skarura Indian named Kukwamukwa. Although he was a chief, he was denied personhood and was not allowed to marry her mother, a white woman. My birth was recorded as legitimate. The other Sylvia was labeled a bastard. Does that make me special? I lived in North Carolina for only a month. My dad, whose mind had been expanded during a 5-year stint in the Navy, mostly overseas, decided he could no longer bear to live in the segregated South where he'd grown up. He took a job at Henry Ford Hospital in Detroit, and we moved to the suburb of Dearborn. Henry Ford had built Dearborn as a whites-only community to house his factory workers. Both whites and blacks from the South were drawn to the growing auto and war industries in Detroit, where they hoped to prosper economically. But blacks were allowed jobs in Henry Ford's factories only as janitors or cleaners, or in the most dangerous jobs, hazardous jobs in the blast furnace and foundries. But then union organizers joined forces with blacks who were opposing the Ku Klux Klan, protesting discrimination in employment and housing, and demanding increased effective representation in politics. Working together, they formed the powerful United Auto Workers Union, which broke the open shop policy in Henry Ford's factories. By World War II, Detroit found itself at the forefront of the civil rights movement, despite the intentions of Henry Ford. When I was 4, my family moved to Cincinnati, Ohio, where I experienced the first racially tinged incident of my life. My folks were scoping out a Unitarian church in Cincinnati and were jawboning with an African-American couple, while my sister and my brothers and I were frolicking with their children. Two of the children were light-skinned with curly blonde hair, and one boy was extremely dark in skin, hair, and eye color. The lighter children gaily taunted their brother with the N-word, while he looked crushed and ashamed. My siblings and I were horrified. I don't think we'd ever heard the N-word. But we felt it must be bad. Sorry. Judging from the sadness of that boy,
Later, our folks clued us in and said that some people, even people of color, thought light skin was superior to dark skin. I learned other attitudes about white superiority and fear of African Americans when my mom ordered us to lock the doors and roll up the windows when we drove through the African American neighborhood on Vine Street. On sweltering summer nights, boisterous black men thronged the streets, towering about our car in long slacks and wife beater shirts. Why were these men roaming around in the streets and not with my family like my dad? They must be dangerous, or maybe they would pull us over or rob us or beat us up. I still feel wary if I encounter a black man at night and have to remind myself that I would feel differently if he were white. We lived in a world cocooned in whiteness. The only African Americans I ever saw up close were the ancient peanut vendor at the farmer's market dressed in dilapidated top hat and tails, or the women dressed to the nines who arrived by bus in my suburban neighborhood to work for some of our neighbors, or the wiry man clinging to the outside of the truck who hoisted our garbage cans while a white man drove the truck. I knew even as a child all was not well in Cincinnati. My own neighborhood was marred by nasty religious disputes between Protestants and Jews allied against Catholics that were displayed in personal vendettas, vandalism, and contentious school board elections. A couple of our neighbors had stores downtown that had been looted purportedly by blacks. Cincinnati has long suffered from strained race relations, usually related to substandard working and living conditions, corrupt politics, or inequitable administration of justice. Some of the worst race riots in U.S. history have occurred there, 10 of them dating from 1792 to the most recent in 2001, when an unarmed African-American teenage boy was killed. Our Unitarian minister and some people in our congregation participated in civil rights marches downtown in the early 60s, but not my parents. They didn't like to make waves. I felt a nagging disappointment. When I was 14, my family moved to a small town in overwhelmingly white Southwest Virginia. The state had finally lost its appeals against integrating the public schools. All of the African-American students in a several county area had been collected and bused daily to a common school while the white students went to local schools. But now their school had been closed, their black teachers dismissed to who knows where. An underling position was made for their black superintendent, and their black principal became coach of the JV football team and, unbelievably, study hall monitor. We were pained for them and expressed our dismay within our family, but we did nothing. I still wonder what we newcomers, already viewed suspiciously as Yankees and Unitarians, could have and should have done. Last year, I read about the Black Trail of Tears. I'd never wondered before about the logistics of selling unruly or excess slaves down south. From a firsthand written account, I learned those unfortunates were collected from Virginia's coastal tidewater plantations, marched in chain columns westward, collecting more slaves for sale from plantations of famous statesmen like James Madison or George Washington, onward to my old hometown. In Radford, Virginia, they were forced by their handler, who was too cheap to pay for a ferry, to cross the Whitewater New River, still chained together. Imagine the terror those people must have felt. My dad had high regard for a black man named Walter Price. Walter managed the kitchen in the hospital where they both worked. My dad said Walter was a capable and intelligent man who had been held back only in life because he was black. Once when I was in grad school in Madison, Wisconsin, I was walking around the state capitol when a black man waved at me. It was Walter Price. He proudly introduced me to his African-American companion, the husband of a black woman, who had risen to the position of Dean of Arts of the University of Wisconsin. She had escaped the institutional racism of Virginia to achieve a prestigious position up north. My husband Dick and I moved to East Lansing, Michigan, when most of our closest friends and coworkers were Japanese, Indian, or Indonesian, but we knew nary an African-American academic, even while Michigan State's dream team of black athlete warriors were winning the NCAA championship. The young woman I considered my closest friend was Indian. One day, Nalini told me she could only have a true friendship with another Indian woman. I was crushed. Malcolm X grew up in Lansing, Michigan, the working people's counterpart to the intellectuals' whiter East Lansing where we lived. His father, was a spokesperson for the black separatist Marcus Garvey. One night, his head was bashed in and his body tossed across the trolley tracks where it was almost severed. His life insurer ruled his death a suicide and refused to pay up. Malcolm's mother struggled to support her 8 children, but Malcolm and his 7 siblings were separated and sent to foster care. When Dick and I moved to Manhattan in 1979, we wondered, where are all the black people? In 1979, all people of color made up only about 6% of Manhattan's population. Jack Goldstein, a prominent businessman, told me that prior to the early 70s, African Americans alone comprised 12% of Manhattan's population. During his tenure on city council, against his wishes, a $7 million urban renewal grant was used to obliterate the neighborhood where African and Hispanic American people lived in unplumbed houses and even boxcars. No provision was made to replace their housing. And according to Mr. Goldstein, they mostly moved to Junction City and Topeka. I've worked plots in Manhattan Community Garden for 25 years on that vacated property. I first became aware through my children of the isolation, alienation, and discrimination their classmates of color faced inside and outside of school. Sadly, not from my own personal initiative, but from the invitation or insistence of parents of some of these children, we made a traveling exhibit of famous African Americans and found people of color to perform in the grade schools. I was also fortunate to be part of a summer school fine arts program, Columns of Culture, spearheaded by Cindy and Richard Pitts, which featured African, Hispanic, Asian, and Native American cultures. This now extinct summer program evolved, mostly with the efforts of the Pittses, into Wonder Workshop Children's Museum, where Mr. Pitts is the director. I thank Richard, who has hired my children and allowed my husband and me to be part of Wonder Workshop's forward-thinking and creative programming, for expanding our sense of human family. About 10 years ago, a friend insisted I help convince the high school to hire a diversity coordinator. I agreed to address the school board. Many people of color spoke eloquently and movingly, mixing research, logic, and personal anecdotes to make their points, asking, even begging, the school district to hire a diversity coordinator. I spoke last. Afterwards, a white school board member told me I was the most convincing and articulate speaker. I knew that was not true. 2 black mothers thanked me for speaking and said, white people often hear things better when a white person says them. My current job at People's Grocery is a drastic departure from research and teaching jobs I've held previously. Being in a service position has given me the face-to-face mission of waiting on and making others feel comfortable, a posture frequently reserved for people of color in this country. This is a new perspective that has opened to me some interesting and fulfilling relationships with people of color as well as whites I might never have known. These are just some of the things that have occurred on my own continuing path to learn about the history of racism in the U.S. and to grasp the meaning of my white privilege. A person need not feel apologetic or defensive for being white. One is not responsible for his racial heritage or for being raised in a white-dominated racist society in which one has been trained to have particular responses to people of color. One is responsible for how she responds to racism. What can we do to defeat racism? How do we create a society where one's position in the power structure is not skewed by race, and each person enjoys equal privilege, opportunity, and access to the economic ladder? A first goal is to heal one's own internal racism. Internalized racism spawns the dynamics of superiority, inferiority, and breeds the suspicion, hatred, fear, anxiety, resentment, frustration that degrade both dominant and non-dominant peoples. A second goal is to be a force for unity in one's community. However, goal number 2 cannot be accomplished without a complete commitment to goal number 1, healing one's own internalized racism. These are some of the steps we can take to accomplish these goals. And Grace has already mentioned a lot of these. We can internalize the truth of the oneness of humankind. We can resolve to learn the full history of racism in our country. We can understand how racism affects all of us. We can acknowledge the privileges and entitlements we automatically enjoy because of our position in the racial power structure. We can understand that saying we are tolerant or colorblind are ways of glossing over the differences that divide people just to avoid uncomfortable situations that could lead to misunderstandings or conflict. We can practice listening and realize that learning is transmitted in both directions. We can be more noticing about the racial mix in our community, who is doing the invisible work, and who are in the positions of power. We must not remain silent when people around us, family, friends, coworkers, make racist comments. We need to be involved in social activism. We can create ways to come together on equal footing to take positive action in a safe, non-confrontational environment. We will make mistakes and errors. Making changes involves taking risks. We have time for some brief discussion, and I know this is a humongous topic. We'll have to keep talking and commit our fellowship to trying to do more. So the microphone's coming around. Oh, do you guys want to come up here?
Pat Embers. Regarding Native American racism and anti-racism, there is an incredible speech on Facebook that is on my Facebook, Pat Embers, and if I can get it on the Unitarian, I will, the Coffee and Conversation, by Lawrence O'Donnell of MSNBC, the 24 channel on television. MSNBC, thank you. It is just incredible to hear this because it is... he is himself, and those of us that have seen him often, but he is really revealing and very clear about our racism against Native Americans and how the genocide massacre has occurred. And you feel this inside when you hear this, and I would encourage you to find this Facebook post.
I wanted to say something about the mascot at Manhattan High School as well. There is, of course, a lot of controversy about this. I recently sent an email to a board member saying that the genocide of the Native Americans is just as much a genocide as it was the Jews of Europe. And so to think of a Jew as a mascot would be truly unthinkable in a European context. It would be against the law. But I also know that many people are attached to this history, and I kind of suggested that they rename the high school to Manhattan Indian Memorial High School. And that way, I think it would honor the Indian and maybe... it would be a compromise in this issue. So there are a lot of discussions going on right now.
Glenna Burkle, just quickly, the question about whether racism is inborn or not. My mother told me that I was with her on a bus and that there was a little black girl across from us. And I was clearly going to say something, and she didn't know what, and she was very nervous that I might say something unfortunate. And apparently what I did say, thank God, was, she has a nice, shiny brown face. I was also thinking of the song from South Pacific, You've Got to Be Taught. I think all of you are familiar with that. And also I think engagement with the Douglas Center is a constructive thing. I've been involved with that for quite a while.
Hi, I'm Stu Stanton. We all have our story, and it's who we are, and we don't have any, we do things based on that story because there isn't anything else that we know how to do. And yesterday I had an interesting experience that kind of touched on that and left me a bit uncertain, in fact, a great deal uncertain. I was at the library, and I go to the library a lot recently studying some stuff that's really hard for me, and it puts me to sleep. And everybody who goes to the library and reads for much time or does their thing and nerding out at the library, sleeps at the library. It's just a fact of life. There's a game you play to how to keep a book in front of you so you hold your head so that you don't look like you're asleep or something, because there's a culture we try to fit. My favorite chair, I didn't sit in because I sleep too much in that chair. And the problem with it is I don't get enough done. But yesterday I was at the library sitting at the upright, uncomfortable chair, trying to stay awake, and there was a guy sleeping in the chair that I usually sleep in, or sit in and work and inadvertently fall asleep. And the librarian came by, or one of the library staff, and woke him up. And at that point, I realized that without thinking much about it, that he was black, rather well-dressed guy. And she asked him if he had been asked to leave. And he said no. And she asked him a second time, and he said no. And so she, oh, well, and then he went on. And I couldn't help myself. Just about the time she got out of hearing range, I said, what was that about? And then she went around the corner. He said he'd been approached four times. He says the fifth time is coming up. And he was well-dressed. He had a T-shirt on and a shirt over it. It was open. It was ironed. He carried a backpack like I do. His backpack looked better than mine. And he said they just keep coming. Now, I've got to say, he'd been asleep for an hour. And by the time I left, he'd been asleep 3 hours. And he wasn't making any of my efforts to kind of just obscure the fact that I'm asleep, or sit apologetically while you're asleep, or whatever it might be. I was trying to decide what I would say if the librarian came up. Now, I've been on library boards. Now, I'm one board, and it was a small town, but every library board member takes their library board stuff really seriously. And I understand what the librarian was concerned about, or the staffer, because you can't be you don't want to be the bedroom facility for the homeless in the town. But this guy looked like he worked really hard to not look it. He could have been a professor. He could have been a lawyer. He could have been a street person, depending on. He was well-pressed, well-dressed, polite. He did sleep with his mouth open, which we all would be horrified if we got caught doing that in the library and worry about. But my thought was, what I would have to say is, we don't get to pick and choose anymore. That's what Ferguson teaches us. And beyond that, you guys got to lighten up, because you can't. And then looked over, and there's some white dude with his hands crossed right in front of his computer, sound asleep. And he pointed him out and said, they didn't check him, only checked me 4 times. I understand from the library's point of view. I understand from the guy's point of view. I don't know how much of this is self-inflicted by him or by us. I don't have any answer, except that you can't pick and choose.
So we're kind of over time. So let's go ahead and do our closing hymn, Common Thread. It's in your bulletin.
Together we will rise.
With closing words, we have come together to share our deepest concerns, speaking and singing words of inspiration and hope. We have committed ourselves to do what we can to ease the burdens of those who suffer, to stand for decency and compassion. We have pledged to work for a more wholesome environment for us and for all the generations that will follow. But these are just words. The hymns we sing are just songs. All reflections are just idle thoughts. When we convert them all into loving and responsible action throughout the week, then only then will this morning become what we want to be, a time of worship. Go now in peace. Okay.